9. 2 days before the Legion's assault on the Whisperheads, Loken had consented to another private interview with the Remembrancer Mercedes Ollerton. It was the third such interview he had granted since his election to the Morneville, at which time his attitude towards her seemed to have substantially altered. Though the subject had not been mentioned formally, Mercedes had begun to feel that Loken had chosen her to be his particular memorialist. He had told her on the night of his election that he might choose to share his recollections with her, but she was now secretly astonished at the extent of his eagerness to do so. She had already recorded almost 6 hours of reminiscence, accounts of battles and tactics, descriptions of especially demanding military operations, reflections on the qualities of certain types of weapon, celebrations of notable deeds and triumphs accomplished by his comrades. In the time between interviews, she took herself to her room and processed the material, composing it into the skeleton of a long, fluid account. She hoped eventually to have a complete history of the expedition, and a more general record of the Great Crusade, as witnessed by Loken during the other expeditions that had preceded the 63rd. Indeed, the weight of anecdotal facts she was gathering was huge, but one thing was lacking, and that was Loken himself. In the latest interview, she tried once again to draw out some spark of the man.
"As I understand it," she said, "you have nothing in you that we ordinary mortals might know as fear."
Loken paused and frowned. He had been lapping a plate section of his armor. This seemed to be his favorite diversion when in her company. He would call her to his private arming chamber and sit there, scrupulously polishing his war harness while he spoke and she listened. To Mercedes, the particular smell of the lapping powder had become synonymous with the sound of his voice and the matter of his tales. He had well over a century of stories to tell.
"A curious question," he said.
"And how curious is the answer?"
Loken shrugged lightly.
"The Astartes have no fear. It is unthinkable to us."
"Because you have trained yourself to master it?"
Mercedes asked.
"No. We are trained for discipline, but the capacity for fear is bred out of us. We are immune to its touch."
Mercedes made a mental note to edit this last comment later. To her, it seemed to leech away some of the heroic mystique of the Astartes. To deny fear was the very character of a hero. But there was nothing courageous about being insensible to the emotion. She wondered, too, if it was possible to simply remove an entire emotion from what was essentially a human mind. Did that not leave a void? Were other emotions compromised by its lack? Could fear even be removed cleanly? Or did its excision tear out shreds of other qualities along with it? It certainly might explain why the Astartes seemed larger than life in almost every aspect except their own personalities.
"Well, let us continue," she said. "At our last meeting, you were going to tell me about the war against the Overseers. That was 20 years ago, wasn't it?"
He was still looking at her, eyes slightly narrowed.
"What?"
he asked.
"I'm sorry?"
"What is it? You didn't like my answer just then."
Mercedes cleared her throat.
"No, not at all. It wasn't that. I had just been..."
"What?"
"May I be candid?"
"Of course,"
he said, patiently rubbing a nub of polishing fiber around the edges of a pot.
"I had been hoping to get something a little more personal. You have given me a great deal, sir, authentic details and points of fact that would make any history text authoritative. Posterity will know with precision, for instance, which hand the Acton Cruz carried his sword in, the colour of the sky over the monastery cities of Nabatea, the methodology of the White Scar's favoured pincer assault, the number of studs on the shoulder plate of a lunar wolf, the number of axe blows, and from which angles it took to fell the last of the Omakad princes."
She looked at him squarely.
"But nothing about you, sir. I know what you saw, but not what you felt."
"What I felt? Why would anyone be interested in that?"
"Humanity is a sensible race, sir. Future generations, those that our remembrances are intended for, will learn more from any factual record if those facts are couched in an emotional context. They will care less for the details of the battles at Ulanor, for instance, than they will for a sense of what it felt like to be there."
"Are you saying that I'm boring?"
Loken asked.
"No, not at all,"
she began, and then realized he was smiling.
"Some of the things you have told me sound like wonders, yet you do not yourself seem to wonder at them. If you know no fear, do you also not know awe, surprise, majesty? Have you not seen things so bizarre they left you speechless, shocked you, unnerved you even?"
"I have," he said. "Many times the sheer oddity of the cosmos has left me bemused or startled."
"So tell me of those things."
He pursed his lips and thought about it.
"Giant hats," he began.
"I beg your pardon?"
"On Saracel, after Compliance, the citizens held a great carnival of celebration. Compliance had been bloodless and willing. The carnival ran for 8 weeks. The dancers in the streets wore giant hats of ribbon and cane and paper, each one fashioned into some gaudy form. A ship, a sword and fist, a dragon, a sun. They were as broad across as my span."
Loken spread his arms wide.
"I do not know how they balanced them, or suffered their weight, but day and night they danced along the inner streets of the main city, these garish forms weaving and bobbing and circling, as if carried along on a slow flood, quite obscuring the human figures beneath. It was an odd sight."
"I believe you."
"It made us laugh. It made Horus laugh to see it."
"Was that the strangest thing you ever knew?"
"No. No. Let's see. The method of war on Kalek gave us all pause. This was 80 years ago. The Kalekid were a grotesque alien kind, of a manner you might describe as reptilian. They were greatly skilled in the arts of combat, and rose against us angrily the moment we made contact. Their world was a harsh place. I remember crimson rock and indigo water. The commander, this was long before he was made War Master, expected a prolonged and brutal struggle, for the Kalekid were large and strong creatures. Even the least of their warriors took 3 or 4 bolt rounds to bring down. We drew forth upon their world to make war, but they would not fight us."
"How so?"
"We did not comprehend the rules they fought by. As we learned later, the Kalekid considered war to be the most abhorrent activity a sentient race could indulge in, so they set upon it tight controls and restrictions. There were large structures upon the surface of their world, rectangular fields many kilometers in dimension, covered with high, flat roofs, and open at the sides. We named them slaughterhouses, and there was one every few 100 kilometers. The Kalekid would only fight at these prescribed places. The sites were reserved for combat. War was forbidden on any other part of their world's surface. They were waiting for us to meet them at a slaughterhouse and decide the matter."
"How bizarre. What was done about it?"
"We destroyed the Kalekid," he said, matter-of-factly.
"Oh,"
she replied, with a tilt of her abnormally long head.
"It was suggested that we might meet them and fight them by the terms of their rules," Loken said. "There may have been some honour in that, but Malagurst, I think it was, reasoned that we had rules of our own which the enemy chose not to recognise. Besides, they were formidable. Had we not acted decisively, they would have remained a threat, and how long would it have taken them to learn new rules or abandon old ones?"
"Is an image of them recorded?" Mercedes asked.
"Many, I believe. The preserved cadaver of one of their warriors is displayed in this ship's Museum of Conquest, and since you ask what I feel, sometimes it is sadness. You mentioned the Overseers, a story I was going to tell. That was a long campaign, and one which filled me with misery."
As he told the story, she sat back, occasionally blink-clicking to store his image. He was concentrating on the preparation of his armor, but she could see sadness behind that concern. The Overseers, he explained, were a machine race, and, as artificial sentience, quite beyond the limits of imperial law. Machine life, untempered by organic components, had long been outlawed by both the Imperial Council and the Mechanicum. The Overseers, commanded by a senior machine called the Arch-Droid, inhabited a series of derelict, crumbling cities on the world of Dahinta. These were cities of fine mosaics, which had once been very beautiful indeed. but extreme age and decay had faded them. The overseers scuttled amongst the mouldering piles, fighting a losing battle of repair and refurbishment in a single-minded obsession to keep the neglected cities intact. The machines had eventually been destroyed after a lasting and brutal war, in which the skills of the Mechanicum had proved invaluable. Only then was the sad secret found.
"The overseers were the product of human ingenuity," Loken said.
"Humans made them?"
"Yes. Thousands of years ago, perhaps even during the last age of technology. Dahinta had been a human colony, home to a lost branch of our race, where they had raised a great and marvelous culture of magnificent cities, with thinking machines to serve them. At some time, and in a manner unknown to us, the humans had become extinct. They left behind their ancient cities, empty, but for the deathless guardians they had made. It was most melancholy, and passing strange."
"Did the machines not recognize men?" she asked.
"All they saw were the Astartes, lady, and we did not look like the men they had called master."
She hesitated for a moment, then said, "I wonder if I shall witness so many marvels as we make this expedition."
"I trust you will, and I hope that many will fill you with joy and amazement rather than distress. I should tell you some time of the great triumph after Ulanor. That was an event that should be remembered."
"I look forward to hearing it."
"There is no time now. I have duties to attend to."
"One last story, then? A short one, perhaps? Something that filled you with awe?"
He sat back and thought.
"There was a thing. No more than 10 years ago. We found a dead world where life had once been. A species had lived there once, and either died out or moved to another world. They had left behind them a honeycomb of subterranean habitats, dry and dead. We searched them carefully, every last cave and tunnel, and found just one thing of note. It was buried deepest of all, in a stone bunker 10 kilometers under the planet's crust. A map. A great chart, in fact, fully 20 meters in diameter, showing the geophysical relief of an entire world in extraordinary detail. We did not at first recognize it, but the Emperor, beloved of all, knew what it was."
"What?" she asked.
"It was Terra. It was a complete and full map of Terra. Perfect in every detail. But it was a map of Terra from an age long gone, before the rise of the hives or the molestation of war, with coastlines and oceans and mountains of an aspect long since erased or covered over."
"That is amazing," she said.
He nodded.
"So many unanswerable questions, locked into one forgotten chamber. Who had made the map, and why? What business had brought them to Terra so long ago? What had caused them to carry the chart across half the galaxy and then hide it away, like their most precious treasure, in the depths of their world? It was unthinkable. I cannot feel fear, Mistress Oliton. But if I could, I would have felt it then. I cannot imagine anything ever unsettling my soul the way that thing did."
Unthinkable. Time had slowed to a pinprick point on which it seemed all the gravity in the cosmos was pressing. Loken felt lead heavy, slow, out of joint, unable to frame a lucid response or even begin to deal with what he was seeing.
Was this fear? Was he tasting it now, after all? Was this how terror cowed a mortal man?
Sergeant Udon, his helm a deformed ring of bloody ceramite, lay dead at his feet. Beside him sprawled two other battle brothers, shot point-blank through the hearts, if not dead, then fatally damaged. Before him stood Jubal, the bolter in his hand. This was madness. This could not be. Astartes had turned upon Astartes. A lunar wolf had murdered his own kind. Every law of fraternity and honor that Loken understood and trusted had just been torn as easily as a cobweb. The insanity of this crime would echo forever.
"Jubal! What have you done?"
"Not Jubal. Samus. I am Samus.
Samus is all around you. Samus is the man beside you.
Jubal's voice had a catch to it, a dry giggle. Loken knew he was about to fire again. The rest of Udon's squad, quite as aghast as Loken, stumbled forward, but none raised their bolters. Even in the stark light of what Jubal had just done, not one of them could break the sworn code of the Astartes and fire upon one of their own. Loken knew he certainly couldn't. He threw his bolter aside and leapt at Jubal. Xavier Jubal, commander of Hellebore Squad and one of the finest file officers in the company, had already begun to fire. Bolt rounds screeched out across the chamber and struck into the hesitating squad. Another helmet exploded in a welter of blood, bone chips and armor fragments, and another battle brother crashed to the cave floor. Two more were knocked down beside him as bolt rounds detonated against their torso armor. Loken smashed into Jubal and staggered him backwards, trying to pin his arms. Jubal thrashed, sudden fury in his limbs.
"Samus!" he yelled. "It means the end and the death. Samus will gnaw upon your bones!"
They crashed against a rock wall together with numbing force, splintering stone. Jubal would not relinquish his grip on the murder weapon. Loken drove him backwards against the rock, the drizzle of meltwater spraying down across them both.
"Jubal!"
Loken threw a punch that would have decapitated a mortal man. His fist cracked against Jubal's helm, and he repeated the action, driving his fist four or five times against the other's face and chest. The ceramite visor chipped. Another punch, his full weight behind it, and Jubal stumbled. Each stroke of Loken's fist resounded like a smith's hammer in the echoing chamber, steel against steel. As Jubal stumbled, Loken grabbed his bolter and tore it out of his hand. He hurled it away across the deep stone well. But Jubal was not yet done. He seized Loken and slammed him sideways into the rock wall. Lumps of stone flew out from the jarring impact. Jubal slammed him again, swinging Loken bodily into the rock, like a man swinging a heavy sack. Pains flared through Loken's head, and he tasted blood in his mouth. He tried to pull away, but Jubal was throwing punches that ploughed into Loken's visor and bounced the back of his head off the wall repeatedly. The other men were upon them, shouting and grappling to separate them.
"Hold him!" Loken yelled. "Hold him down!"
They were Astartes, as strong as young gods in their power armor, but they could not do as Loken ordered. Jubal lashed out with a free fist and knocked one of them clean off his feet. Two of the remaining three clung to his back like wrestlers, like human cloaks, trying to pull him down, but he hoisted them up and twisted, throwing them off him. Such strength! Such unthinkable strength that could shrug off Astartes like target dummies in a practice cage. Jubal turned on the remaining brother, who launched himself forward to tackle the madman.
"Look out!" Jubal screamed with a cackle. "Samus is here!"
His lancing right hand met the brother head-on. Jubal struck with an open hand, fingers extended, and those fingers drove clean in through the battle brother's gorget as surely as any spear tip. Blood squirted out from the man's throat, through the puncture in the armor. Jubal ripped his hand out, and the brother fell to his knees, choking and gurgling, blood pumping in profuse, pulsing surges from his ruptured throat. Beyond any thought of reason now, Loken hurled himself at Jubal, but the berserker turned and smacked him away with a mighty backhand slap. The power of the blow was stupendous, far beyond anything even an Astartes should have been able to wield. The force was so great that the armor of Jubal's gauntlet fractured, as did the plating of Loken's shoulder, which took the brunt. Loken blacked out for a split second, then was aware that he was flying. Jubal had struck him so hard that he was sailing across the stone well and out over the abyssal fault. Loken struck the arching pier of stone steps. He almost bounced off it. But he managed to grab on, his fingers gouging the ancient stone, his feet swinging above the drop. Meltwater poured down in a thin rain across him, making the steps slick and oily with mineral wash. Loken's fingers began to slide. He remembered dangling in a similar fashion over the tower lip in the Emperor's palace, and snarled in frustrated rage. Fury pulled him up. Fury and an intense passion that he would not fail the War Master. Not in this. Not in the face of this terrible wrong. He hauled himself upright onto the pier. It was narrow, no wider than a single path where men could not pass if they met. The gulf, black as the outer void, yawned below him. His limbs were shaking with effort. He saw Jubal. He was charging forward across the cavern to the foot of the steps, drawing his combat blade. The sword glowed as it powered into life. Loken wrenched out his own sword. Falling meltwater hissed and sparked as it touched the active metal of the short, stabbing blade. Jubal bounded up the steps to meet him, slashing with his sword. He was raving still, in a voice that was in no way his own any longer. He struck wildly at Loken, who hopped back up the steps, and then began to deflect the strikes with his own weapon. Sparks flashed, and the blades struck one another like the tolling of a discordant bell. Height was not an advantage in this fight, as Loken had to hunch low to maintain his guard. Combat swords were not dueling weapons. Short and double-edged, they were made for stabbing, for battlefield onslaught. They had no reach or subtlety. Jubal hacked with his like an axe, forcing Loken to defend. Their blades cut falling water as they scythed, sizzling and billowing steam into the air. Loken prided himself on maintaining a masterful discipline and practice of all weapons. He regularly clocked 6 or 8 hours at a time in the flagship's practice cages. He expected all of the men in his command to do likewise. Xavier Jubal, he knew, was foremost a master with daggers and sparring axes, but no slouch with the sword. Except today. Jubal had discarded all his skill, or had forgotten it in the flush of madness that had engulfed his mind. He attacked Loken like a maniac, in a frenzy of savage cuts and blows. Loken was likewise forced to dispense with much of his skill in an effort to block and parry. 3 times Loken managed to drive Jubal back down the pier a few steps, but always the other man retaliated and forced Loken higher up the arch. Once, Loken had to leap to avoid a low slice, and barely regained his footing as he landed. In the silver downpour, the steps were treacherous, and it was as much a fight to keep balance as to resist Jubal's constant assault. It ended suddenly, like a jolt. Jubal passed Loken's guard and sunk the full edge of his blade into Loken's left shoulder plate.
"Samus is here!" he cried in delight.
But his blade, flaring with power, was wedged fast.
"Samus is done," Loken replied,
and drove the tip of his sword into Jubal's exposed chest. The sword punched clean through, and the tip emerged through Jubal's back. Jubal wavered, letting go of his own weapon, which remained transfixed through Loken's shoulder guard. With half-open, shuddering hands, he reached at Loken's face, not violently, but gently, as if imploring some mercy or even aid. Water splashed off them and streamed down their white plating.
"Samus!" he gasped.
Loken wrenched his sword out. Jubal staggered and swayed, the blood leaking out of the gash in his chestplate, diluting as soon as it appeared and mixing with the drizzle, covering his belly plate and thigh armor with a pink stain. He toppled backwards, crashing over and over down the steps in a windmill of heavy, loose limbs. 5 meters from the base of the pier, his headlong career bounced him half off the steps, and he came to a halt, legs dangling, partly hanging over the chasm, gradually sliding backwards under his own weight. Loken heard the slow squeal of armor scraping against slick stone. He leapt down the flight to reach Jubal's side. He got there just moments before Jubal slid away into oblivion. Loken grabbed Jubal by the edge of his left shoulder plate and slowly began to heave him back onto the pier. It was almost impossible. Jubal seemed to weigh 1 billion tons. The 3 surviving members of Breakspur Squad stood at the foot of the steps, watching him struggle.
"Help me!"
Loken yelled.
"To save him?"
one asked.
"Why?"
asked another.
"Why would you want to?"
"Help me!"
Loken snarled again. They didn't move. In desperation, Loken raised his sword and stabbed it down, spearing Jubal's right shoulder to the steps. So pinned, his slide was arrested. Loken hauled Jubal's body back onto the pier. Panting, Loken dragged off his battered helm and spat out a mouthful of blood.
"Get Vipers," he ordered. "Get him now!"
By the time they were conducted up to the plateau, there wasn't much to see, and the light was failing. Euphrati took a few random pics of the parked stormbirds and the cone of smoke lifting off the broken crag, but she didn't expect much from any of them. It all seemed drab and lifeless up there. Even the vista of the mountains around them was insipid.
"Can we see the combat area?"
she asked Cinderman.
"We've been told to wait."
"Is there a problem?"
He shook his head. It was an I-don't-know kind of shake. Like all of them, he was strapped into his rebreather, but he looked frail and tired. It was eerily quiet. Groups of lunar wolves were trudging back to the stormbirds from the fastness, and army troops had secured the plateau itself. The remembrancers had been told that a solid victory had been achieved, but there was no sign of jubilation.
"Oh, it's a mechanical thing," Cinderman said when Euphrati questioned him. "This is just a routine exercise for the Legion. A low-key action, as I said before we set out. I'm sorry if you're disappointed."
"I'm not," she said.
But in truth, there was a sense of anticlimax about it all. She wasn't sure what she had been expecting, but the rush of the drop and the strange circumstance at Kashiri had begun to thrill her. Now everything was done, and she'd seen nothing.
"Karnis wants to interview some of the returning warriors," Simon Sark said, "and he's asked me to pick them while he does. Would that be permissible?"
"I should think so," Cinderman sighed. He called out for an army officer to guide Karnis and Sark to the Astartes.
"I think," said Ptolemy Van Craston aloud, "that a tone poem would be most appropriate. Full symphonic composition would overwhelm the atmosphere, I feel."
Euphrati nodded, not really understanding.
"A minor key, I think. E or A, perhaps. I'm taking with the title The Spirits of the Whisperheads, or perhaps The Voice of Samus. What do you think?"
She stared at him.
"I'm joking," he said with a sad smile.
"I have no idea what I'm supposed to respond to here, or how. It all seems so dour."
Euphrati Keeler had supposed Van Craston to be a pompous type, but now she warmed to him. As he turned away and gazed mournfully up at the smoking peak, she was seized by a thought and raised her picture.
"Did you just take my likeness?"
he asked. She nodded.
"Do you mind?
You looking at the peak like that seemed to sum up how we all feel."
"But I'm a remembrancer," he said.
"Should I be in your record?"
"We're all in this. Witnesses or not, we're all here,"
she replied.
"I take what I see. Who knows?
Maybe you can return the favour. A little refrain of flutes in your next overture that represents Euphrati Keeler?"
They both laughed. A lunar wolf was approaching the huddle of them.
"Nero Vipus," he said, making the sign of the Aquila. "Captain Loken presents his respects and wishes the attention of Master Cinderman at once."
"I'm Cinderman," the elderly man replied. "Is there some problem, sir?"
"I've been asked to conduct you to the captain," Vipus replied. "This way, please."
The pair of them moved away, Cinderman scurrying to keep up with Vipus's great strides.
"What is going on?"
Van Craston asked, his voice hushed.
"I don't know. Let's find out," Keeler replied.
"Follow them? Oh, I don't think so."
"I'm game," said Borodin Flora. "We haven't actually been told to stay here."
They looked round. Twell had sat himself down beside the prow landing strut of a stormbird and was beginning to sketch with charcoal sticks on a small pad. Karnis and Sark were busy elsewhere.
"Come on,"
said Euphrati Keeler. Vipers led Cinderman up into the ruined fastness. The wind moaned and whistled through the grim tunnels and chambers. Army troopers were clearing the dead from the entry halls and casting them into the gorge, but still Vipers had to steer the iterator past many crumpled, exploded corpses. He kept saying such things as,
"I'm sorry you had to see that, sir," and "Look away to spare your sensibilities."
Cinderman could not look away. He had iterated loyally for many years, but this was the first time he had walked across a fresh battlefield. The sights appalled him and burned themselves into his memory. The stench of blood and ordure assailed him. He saw human forms burst and brutalized, and burned beyond any measure he had imagined possible. He saw walls sticky with blood and brain matter, fragments of exploded bone, weeping marrow, body parts littering the blood-soaked floors.
Terror,
he breathed, over and again. This was what the Astartes did. This was the reality of the Emperor's crusade. Mortal hurt on a scale that passed belief.
Terror,
he whispered to himself. By the time he was brought to Loken, who awaited him in one of the fortress's upper chambers, the word had become terror, without him realizing it. Loken was standing in a wide, dark chamber beside some sort of pool. Water gurgled down one of the black, wet walls, and the air smelled of damp and oxides. A dozen solemn lunar wolves attended Loken, including one giant fellow in glowering Terminator armor. But Loken himself was bareheaded. His face was smudged with bruises. He'd removed his left shoulder guard, which lay beside him on the ground, stuck through with a short sword.
"You have done such a thing,"
Cinderman said, his voice small.
"I don't think I'd quite understood what you Astartes were capable of. But now I—"
"Quiet,"
Loken said bluntly. He looked at the lunar wolves around him and dismissed them with a nod. They filed out past Cinderman, ignoring him.
"Stay close, Nero," Loken called.
Stepping out through the chamber door, Vipus nodded. Now the room was almost empty. Cinderman could see that a body lay beside the pool. It was the body of a lunar wolf, limp and dead, his helm off, his white armor mottled with blood. His arms had been lashed to his trunk with climbing cable.
Cinderman began. "I don't understand, Captain. I was told there had been no losses."
Loken nodded slowly.
"That's what we're going to say. That will be the official line. The 10th took this fortress in a clean strike, with no losses, and that's true enough. None of the insurgents scored any kills, not even a wounding. We took 1,000 of them to their deaths."
"But this man?"
Loken looked at Cinderman. His face was troubled, more troubled than the iterator had ever seen before.
"What is it, Garvio?"
he asked.
"Something has happened," Loken said. "Something so unthinkable that I—"
He paused and looked at Jubal's bound corpse.
"I have to make a report, but I don't know what to say. I have no frame of reference. I'm glad you are here, Kirill. You of all people. You have steered me well over the years."
"I like to think that."
"I need your counsel now."
Cinderman stepped forward and placed his hand on the giant warrior's arm.
"You may trust me with any matter, Garvio. I'm here to serve."
Loken looked down at him.
"This is confidential. Utterly confidential."
"I understand."
"There have been deaths today. 6 brothers of Breakspur Squad, including Udon. Another barely clinging to life. And Hellebore. Hellebore has vanished. And I fear they are dead too."
"This can't be. The insurgents couldn't have—"
"They did nothing." "This is Xavier Jubal," Loken said, pointing towards the body on the floor. "He killed the men," he said simply.
Cinderman rocked back as if slapped. He blinked.
"He what?" "I'm sorry, Garvio. I thought for a moment you said he—"
"He killed the men. Jubal killed the men. He took his bolter and his fists, and he killed 6 of Breakspur right in front of my eyes. And he would have killed me too, if I hadn't run him through."
Cinderman felt his legs tremble. He found a nearby rock and sat down abruptly.
"Terror,"
he gasped.
"Terror is right. Astartes do not fight Astartes. Astartes do not kill their own. It is against all the rules of nature and man. It is counter to the very gene code the Emperor fused into us when he wrought us."
"There must be some mistake,"
Cinderman said.
"No mistake. I saw him do it. He was a madman. He was possessed."
"What? Steady now.
You look to old terms, Garvio. Possession is a spiritualist word that—" "He was possessed. He claimed he was Samus."
"Oh,"
You've heard the name, then? I've heard the whisper. That was just enemy propaganda, wasn't it? We were told to dismiss it as scare tactics.
Loken touched the bruises on his face, feeling the ache of them.
So I thought. Iterator, I'm going to ask you this once. Are spirits real?
No, sir.
Absolutely not. So we are taught, and thus we are liberated. But could they exist? This world is lousy with superstition and temple fanes. Could they exist here?
No,
Cinderman replied more firmly. There are no spirits, no demons, no ghosts in the dark edges of the cosmos. Truth has shown us this.
I've studied the archive, Kirill,
Loken replied. Samus was the name the people of this world gave to their arch-fiend. He was imprisoned in these mountains, so their legends say.
Legends, Gavir. Only legends. Myths. We have learned much during our time amongst the stars, and the most pertinent of those things is that there is always a rational explanation, even for the most mysterious events.
And Astartes draws his weapon and kills his own, whilst claiming to be a demon from hell. Rationalize that, sir.
Cinderman rose.
Calm yourself, Gavir, and I will.
Loken didn't reply. Cinderman walked over to Jubal's body and stared at it. Jubal's open, staring eyes were rolled back in his skull and utterly bloodshot. The flesh of his face was drawn and shriveled, as if he had aged 10,000 years. Strange patterns, like clusters of blemishes or moles, were visible on the painfully stretched skin.
"These marks," said Cinderman, "these vile signs of wasting. Could they be the traces of disease or infection?"
"What?"
Loken asked. "A virus, perhaps. A reaction to toxicity. A plague."
"Astartes are resistant," Loken said,
"to most things, but not to everything. I think this could be some contagion. Something so virulent that it destroyed Jubal's mind along with his body. Plagues can drive men insane and corrupt their flesh."
"Then why only him?" asked Loken.
Cinderman shrugged.
"Perhaps some tiny flaw in his gene code."
"But he behaved as if possessed," Loken said, repeating the word with brutal emphasis.
"We've all been exposed to the enemy's propaganda. If Jubal's mind was deranged by fever, he might simply have been repeating the words he'd heard."
Loken thought for a moment.
"You speak a lot of sense, Kirill," he said.
"Always."
"A plague,"
Loken nodded.
"It's a sound explanation. You've suffered a tragedy today, Garfield, but spirits and demons played no part in it. Now, get to work. You need to lock down this area in quarantine and get a Medicaid task force here. There may yet be further outbreaks. Non-Astartes, such as myself, might be less resistant, and poor Jubal's corpse may yet be a vector for disease."
Cinderman looked back down at the body.
"Great terror," he said. "He has been so ravaged. I weep to see this waste."
With a creak of dried sinew, Jubal raised his head and stared up at Cinderman with blood-red eyes.
"Look out,"
he wheezed. Euphrates Keeler had stopped taking pics. She stowed away her picter. The things they were seeing in the narrow tunnels of the fortress went beyond all decency to record. She had never imagined that human forms could be dismantled so grievously, so totally. The stench of blood in the close, cold air made her gag, despite her rebreather.
"I want to go back now,"
Van Krasten said. He was shaking and upset.
"There is no music here. I am sick to my stomach."
Euphrates was inclined to agree.
"No," said Borodin Flora, in a muffled, steely voice. "We must see it all. We are chosen remembrances. This is our duty."
Euphrates was quite sure Flora was making an effort not to throw up, but she warmed to the sentiment. This was their duty. This was the very reason they had been summoned. To record and commemorate the crusade of man, whatever it looked like. She tugged her picta back out of its carry bag and took a few tentative shots. Not of the dead, for that would be indecent, but of the blood on the walls, the smoke fuming in the wind along the narrow tunnels, the piles of scattered spent shell cases littering the black-flecked ground. Teams of army troopers moved past them, lugging bodies away for disposal. Some looked at the three of them curiously.
"Are you lost?" one asked.
"Not at all. We're allowed to be here," Flora said.
"Why would you want to be?"
the man wondered. Euphrates took a series of long shots at troopers, almost in silhouette, gathering up body parts at a tunnel junction. It chilled her to see it, and she hoped her picks would have the same effect on her audience.
"I want to go back," Van Krasten said again. "Don't stray, or you'll get lost," Euphrates warned.
"I think I might be sick," Van Krasten admitted.
He was about to retch when a shrill, harrowing scream echoed down the tunnels.
"What the hell was that?"
Euphrates whispered. Jubal rose. The ropes binding him sheared and split, releasing his arms. He screamed, and then screamed again. His frantic wails soared and echoed around the chamber. Cinderman stumbled backwards in total panic. Loken ran forward and tried to restrain the reanimating madman. Jubal struck out with one thrashing fist and caught Loken in the chest. Loken flew backwards into the pool with a crash of water. Jubal turned, hunched. Saliva dangled from his slack mouth, and his bloodshot eyes spun like compasses at true north.
"Please! Oh, please!"
Cinderman gabbled, backing away.
"Look out!"
The words crawled sluggishly out of Jubal's drooling mouth. He lumbered forward. Something was happening to him. Something malign and catastrophic. He was bulging, expanding so furiously that his armor began to crack and shatter. Sections of broken plate split and fell away from him, exposing thick arms swollen with gangrene and fibrous growths. His taut flesh was pallid and blue. His face was distorted, puffy and livid, and his tongue flopped out of his rotting mouth, long and serpentine. He raised his meaty, distended hands triumphantly, exposing fingernails grown into dark hooks and psoriatic claws.
"Samus is here," he drawled.
Cinderman fell on his knees before the misshapen brute. Jubal reeked of corruption and sore wounds. He shambled forward. His form flickered and danced with blurry yellow light, as if he was not quite in phase with the present. A bolter round struck him in the right shoulder and detonated against the rindy integument his skin had become. Shreds of meat and gobbets of pus sprayed in all directions. In the chamber doorway, Nero Vipers took aim again. The thing that had once been Xavier Jubal grabbed Cinderman and threw him at Vipers. The pair of them crashed backwards against the wall, Vipers dropping his weapon in an effort to catch and cushion Cinderman and spare the frail bones of the elderly iterator. The Jubal thing shuffled past them into the tunnel, leaving a noxious trail of dripped blood and wretched discolored fluid in its wake. Euphrates saw the thing coming for them and tried to decide whether to scream or raise her picta. In the end, she did both. Van Krasten lost control of his bodily functions and fell to the floor in a puddle of his own manufacture. Borodin Flora just backed away, his mouth moving silently. The Jubal thing advanced down the tunnel towards them. It was gross and distorted, its skin stretched by humps and swellings. It had become so gigantic that what little remained of its pearl-white armor dragged behind it like metal rags. Strange puncta and moles marked its flesh. Jubal's face had contorted into a dog snout, wherein his human teeth stuck out like stray ivory markers, displaced by the thin, transparent crop of needle fangs that now infested his mouth. There were so many fangs that his mouth could no longer close. His eyes were blood pools. Jerky, spasmodic flashes of yellow light surrounded him, making vague shapes and patterns. They caused Jubal's movements to seem wrong, as if he was a pick-feed image, badly cut and running slightly too fast. He snatched up Ptolemy Van Krasten and dashed him like a toy against the walls of the tunnel, back and forth, with huge, slamming, splattering effect, so that when he let go, little of Ptolemy still existed above the sternum.
"Oh, terror!"
Keela cried, retching violently. Borodin Flora stepped past her to confront the monster, and made the defiant sign of the Aquila.
"Begone!"
he cried out.
"Begone!"
The Jubal thing leaned forward, opened its mouth to a hitherto unimaginable width, revealing an unguessable number of needle teeth, and bit off Borodin Flora's head and upper body. The remainder of his form crumpled to the floor, ejecting blood like a pressure hose. Euphrates Keela sank to her knees. Terror had rendered her powerless to run. She accepted her fate, largely because she had no idea what it was to be. In the final moments of her life, she reassured herself that at least she hadn't added to brutal death the indignity of wetting herself in the face of such incomprehensible horror.